Bradshaw, and I'm 55. It's December 1st, 2004, and we're in Grand Central Terminal. And my relationship to Claudine Ellion is a friend and a colleague. We're both artists.
My name is Claudine Ellion. I'm 53. Today is December 1st, 2004. And we're located in the Grand Central Terminal. And my relationship to Dove Bradshaw is that we're friends, colleagues, and former schoolmates.
Yes, former schoolmates from high school in New York City. As I thought that I would ask you some questions about your formation and thinking as an artist, not, say, general questions about you as a human being. And so the first thing I was wondering was what first prompted you to want to be an artist?
Wanting to be an artist was part of a process which involved stopping my life for a year in New York and then ending up in L.A., where I heard an interview where a man in his 50s said that an 18-year-old had decided that he would be a plumber, meaning himself. And I thought, that's true. What you decide to do when you're younger becomes your life. And so I thought, well, I should find the thing that I want to do that I'm really passionate about. And so I started looking.
How old were you then?
I was 26. And I started looking, and one thing led to another. And because I was doing photography and I was thinking a lot and I was thinking about language, and I started to look at words and at forms, and looking at word elements and forms led me to work with them. And I found that I was doing artwork. I didn't mean to, actually. I was really trying to understand language so that I could understand my thoughts about what it is I was going to do.
Mm-hmm. And so you found yourself making art without even really being aware that it was art.
Right, because I felt that a lot of my experience came from my thoughts, and that there were big subjects like truth or health or honesty or even direction, and I didn't really know what those words implied, that underneath that was this, were all these implications. So I started to look at language elements, and then that led to writing poetry, and then led to doing collages, using images as a kind of lexicon. And I had objections to each one of those media eventually, and that would lead me to the next stage.
So you were actually, let's talk about truth to begin with, since you brought it up, and you weren't going to take it for granted. You were even going to break down the word itself and then look at language itself before you even ventured on an answer to that question.
Yeah, exactly, because you're dealing with things like good and bad, you know, just that basic duality, or right and wrong, or wasting your life or not wasting your life. And, excuse me. So I felt that I didn't even understand what those words meant.
And how did you go about finding out?
Well, I would just sort of keep my eyes open for whatever could be related. So I would look into esoteric stuff, you know, Kabbalistic, when they would add up the numerology of words, or I looked at what colors meant in different cultures to see if there were any kind of universals, because that's what I was wanted, some kind of agreement. And I realized that there are no universals. You can go to different cultures, and white means one thing, mourning in one culture, and it means purity in another. So I did that a little bit like what kids do when they look at books, and first they get familiar with the shapes and then the colors and then the letters and then the numbers. So I did basically the same thing.
And did you, in your exploration, did you meet anyone that was a kind of a mentor for you?
I mean, the mentor, not an ongoing presence, but there would be influence through a book like Krishnamurti's Think on These Things. And his, you know, Krishnamurti in Ojai. And it was basically question authority. And he had been selected from India to become some kind of shining star in the esoteric world. And then he went through some kind of crisis where he was delusional for several days, and he came out of it and renounced it all and said, forget about authority, think about things for yourself. And so I thought, okay, I'll just think for myself.
Well, that's interesting, because one of the things I thought of, Giordano Bruno had said, no man can know the true or the good unless he abhors the multitude. And I was thinking that in the passage from just, thinking about yourself as an artist, and you're going a very different route, what did you have to give up? What teaching in your upbringing did you have to give up to enter this new world?
The teaching, I don't know that it was so much a teaching, unless you take teaching as the way your nervous system is expected to respond to a subject matter. But I had to give up the impression that society, social teachings and imperatives were the last word on how to live a full life.
Mm-hmm. Social mores were the most, binding for you in terms of freedom of expression then.
Yes, especially the social cosmology of thinking this is how reality works, because that to me is the basic question. If you know how, or you're confident at how reality works, you can put a lot of verve in your actions that you can't put if you're not sure, because then you're hesitant. And so understanding the nature of reality seemed very important, and society by default gives you a certain impression of how reality works, and then within that context you're given choices, and you you can make the optimum choice or not.
Yeah. And then as an artist, often I know from my own experience, there's some separation. You feel a natural separation. You see how most people are really undertaking to focus on their lives. They're thinking about getting a job, and the job implies being employed by someone else who has other ideas of what to do with your time. And you're thinking about, you know, building a family or home, those kind of things. They're very different concerns, perhaps, than you're thinking of building as an artist. You might think, well, how am I going to do the work that comes to me to do? How can I get it done? How can I pay for it? How can I get it out in the world? Those kind of questions. And they're really questions of self-employment.
Right.
So how did you think about those kind of things?
Well, I thought that if I start looking at doing artwork as a commercial activity, I'm going to miss the art. I know that was a thought of an afternoon, and it made sense at the time, and I think it still does. So what I would do is I would just do jobs that, like a day job, but on purpose. I didn't want to think about the commercial side. And I just didn't realize it would take that long, because it took 20 years to keep moving forward in the kind of work that I do, so that when I finally had stabilized enough that I could say, okay, this is something I can offer to the marketplace. As you can see, I get all choked up at the idea. Something I can offer to the marketplace.
Money is a very frightening thought.
Well, it's going into the public, but I didn't think about that. I just thought about the activity. And so it's a double shift. You know, it's work on a day job that it really is limited, that it's a 9-to-5, or actually I did a lot of graveyard shifts. Drafting, for example, aerospace, exploded views of engine parts, which later I think I've mentioned this to you. I realized I trained my hand to do ellipses of all sizes, and I would now when I do drawings, I can do really large ellipses, and I go, how did that happen? Because I don't do drawing. I mean, I don't like drawing lessons. So each day job actually taught me something that became useful for myself.
The art world, though, in order to be involved to get your message out, very often, and maybe invariably, thinks of art as a product. Mm-hmm. It's sold in stores, galleries, and even museums are controlled by the galleries, as I have actually discovered literally talking to curators in New York museums, mm-hmm. the Metropolitan, the Whitney, the Modern. And they certainly agree, reluctantly, that the galleries play a hand. And in order to get a voice to be listened to, it seems that you have to get involved in the very American thing of the commercialization of art. And it's really difficult to have a voice in the whole soup mm-hmm. mixture of things without somehow capturing the imagination of some gallery and garnering some kind of success in terms of people buying work to get a chance to, you know, participate.
I agree. A product is necessary, and that's what I have with the artwork that I do. I do have a product. At the same time, I think of it as a byproduct because I could repeat what I do forever, and I know there would be a market for it, but I would have to cultivate that market and, in a way, insist that this is what I'm going to do. But because I work with language, and it's intimately tied in with the way I think life works, I think in a way that artistic success is a reality you create in your intention to create it. Or you can do the certain thing, let's say getting money, which is maximize and manage the potential of anything you do, which you can follow a template. You can go to the galleries, you can send portfolios, you can enter shows, and you can develop an entire CV that has all of these activities on it, including your anti-resume, which features things that didn't pan out. So that's another way. And I could do that, but I like to also experiment with reality and what I do, because I would rather explore and see if the commercial success in the artwork can come another way than doing a lot of this activity, because I really don't want to do it. And in the art, one parameter I have is I don't do it if I don't really enjoy it. That's why I'm doing artwork, because of the freedom. And if I have to start doing things in a certain way and I don't want to do it, then it's not art for me anymore.
That's a very good self-advice. And it's interesting that you say the byproduct because you mention it, because I actually titled a piece once "Bye Bye Products," and Roy Lichtenstein once in his studio, I was looking at some tape that he had pulled off of his paintings, and it was just masking tape, and it was spilling tumultuously off of the side of his desk with little strips of paint on the sides where he had overlapped. And he was using them to as a kind of template, say, to make the zip lines of the sky, the diagonal zip lines of a sky in his cartoons. And looked down and said, "Don't you find that the byproducts are sometimes the most interesting things in your studio?" And he readily agreed. And I think every artist sees that, something that isn't quite a work, but maybe is the most interesting event.
It's certainly the process. I mean, I think art, even it's working on a board, on a drawing table, and making decisions as to how to commit the work to a certain direction or a certain expression, which sometimes means sacrificing a certain direction that would already be good, but taking a chance and altering it midway because it feels like this would be a better work. And it's a gamble because maybe the work will be better, or maybe the certain good work will have been destroyed. And I feel when I do things like that, that I'm really living on the edge. I mean, it's the same, the evil Knievel thing, is that you're jumping into an unknown, and if you don't land correctly, you're going to hurt something. So I find that the process is the most exhilarating part. And I think to some extent, the work that an audience sees gains some of its excitement by hinting at that process and, if possible, pulling in the viewer to think, oh, what an experience it must be to be in the mind state it takes to do that.
That's excellent. It's very interesting. Yeah, exactly. To get behind the scenes so the excitement is conveyed in the actual doing of it.
Right.
Yeah. John Cage famously said that the sounds around us are the most beautiful sounds. And do you think that that's the conundrum of the artist?
Yes, it is. It's, let's say, it wasn't always the conundrum because art, the art product had a certain function, whether it's portraiture or even the exploration of itself on the canvas, let's say culminating in conceptual art. But that art, I believe its elements are interwoven in life all the time. And a specific art situation can sensitize one to color, to form, to sound, so that when you go back into the rush of life, you can isolate certain parts of it that are as much a work of art as that work you saw in a gallery. And it's not the thing itself that is the art. Let's say John Cage is talking about the sound, because if you hear a sound when you're going down the street and you hear a thud, well, it could be somebody getting hit by a car and there's a whole thing, or it could be a package dropping, or it could be
a disaster. No.
A disaster, or it could be something good. I saw a tree that had split and fallen, and so all these branches were sprawled about 15, 20 feet, and it had this caution tape wrapped around it, all of these. And I thought, well, you could see that in a gallery, but it's something that had to happen because of the tree falling and the desire to save the sidewalk. So I think it's the sensitization of perception that hopefully art creates in the viewer that they can bring to their regular lives that is the solution to the conundrum.
Yeah. Well, Duke Ellington was asked to identify his greatest talent, and he responded, I'm the world's greatest listener.
Mm-hmm.
And how would you say that that plays out in your work?
Well, you have a choice in any sensory experience, which is you can take it for your own purposes to stabilize yourself as a human being in the course of events. That means you can listen to somebody and until you have to go somewhere, or you can listen to them until they're done talking. And so I think that you can choose to what degree you want to be sensitive in any given situation. So you can be there. If you're there as an artist, you might say, you know what, I could go and eat something, or I could just stay and watch how this develops.
And in terms of, say, observation, your perceptions, what would you think are your particular insights? Would you say it's part of it? I mean, I'm thinking about you in particular, that you shifted countries.
Mm-hmm.
And so you came here at age 6, and you were adopted. So chance played such a huge part of your life. And suddenly, you switched languages, and in this confusion of cultures and language, and 6 years old, and the idea of parents, and you particularly coming from an orphanage, not having known your biological mother at that time, all of these things are very confusing. And so you're immediately an outsider, outside of two cultures. And that actually is, if you survive it, which you have brilliantly, if you survive it, it gives you the perfect equipment, it seems, to make art, because you're a natural observer. You had to observe 10 times as much as other people who took things for granted, because they didn't question them. They just had one culture, one parent, or two parents at home, or but a more stable situation. One language.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right, because, as you know, I went through 3 languages.
Oh.
You know about that?
Excuse, one more.
Yeah, so the Alsatian Alsatian dialect, and from birth until, I guess, about 5, then from 5 to 6, 6.5, French, then from 6.5 on, English. And so, plus the various foster home, orphanage, adoption. So, in a sense, I didn't know enough to be confused, but rather I just filled in the blanks for myself. And you know how kids are, they just come up with an explanation, and I let it go at that. And it wasn't until much later that I realized my worldview was very unsocialized. I didn't know a lot of the things that other people took for granted, which is why when I got a degree in social sciences, and which it was a triumvirate of sociology, anthropology, and psychology, and I read the sociology, I go, oh, I get it. These are the things that are interwoven into a person's education and preparation to enter society, and it starts so young, you don't even see it. It's so basic to your nervous system. But I didn't have that experience because I didn't understand either cognitively, because I was too young, or linguistically what people were saying. So a lot of it just went nowhere.
Like over your head.
Certainly not into me, and I would just live my life the way kids do. They just live their day. They don't think about the future.
Would you say that imagination then had a big play?
Oh, yeah, sir, certainly.
So you kind of filled in the gaps from your own imagination.
I filled in the gaps that seemed to be required, but I didn't know that there were other gaps, which is why I stopped my life in my mid-20s, because then I said,
you couldn't even know what the gaps are.
I said, I'm confused. Now I had decidedly realized that, having partaken of New York in the 60s, you know, the Andy Warhol crowd, discotheque.
Were you part of that?
Yeah, it was peripherally. I mean, I had friends who were in the arts, and I'm a great tag-along. I'll just go anywhere if I haven't seen it before.
Well, Andy Warhol famously also wanted to be reincarnated as a debutante. And, in fact, he probably would have wanted to be reincarnated as you, since you were literally a candidate. Whether you didn't you say at one point that your mother wanted you to be brought out into society, but that it wasn't hip at that time, so you declined.
Well, it wasn't fun too. I mean, She was in her late 40s when she adopted us, and she grew up in the colonies, you know, as a lot of French people do, in Indochina, and very old school. So
more conservative than French in,
oh, extremely
in
conservative. I mean, I had to wear white gloves when I grew up. I wasn't allowed to wear trousers. You know, that was like the big scandal. And the gloves I lost perpetually and got another set, like at Christmas and promptly.
And how many were in a set?
Well,
seven?
No, but I would lose them the same day.
Oh,
you
good.
Know, go out, volunteer to get something, last minute item at the store and leave them there and come back. But so I was raised very old school, and this notion of a debutante, which I didn't understand the concept, just didn't appeal to me at all, including the formality of it. I mean, I was very tomboyish, so the notion of evening gowns. As I told you, I used to go to the cotillion balls in an evening gown, all made up, and show up and make a scan of who was there and then leave to meet my boyfriend, change back into casual clothes and go to a movie or dinner or anything else, and then change back into the evening gown and come home and say, yeah, so-and-so was there, so-and-so was there.
Well, I've known you for a few years, and actually I've never seen you again. I mean, as we briefly touched on, maybe not in this conversation, but that we went to the same high school.
Right.
And just by default, we're in the same class, although we're in different years.
Mm-hmm.
Because I had some schooling abroad and had to fill in classes from a lower grade. And but I never saw you other than the school uniform in female clothes. You're always wearing trousers. I mean, obviously female clothes. Sounds like
obviously.
A reaction, too.
Well, part of that is practicalities, because I do things, physical things, a lot. I mean, you got to run around. You can't run around in heels. This summer, I was in Amagansett working with a friend of mine, and also we're friends, so I stayed at her house. And she gave me a couple of dresses. You know, chiffon, sequin things. And I went to a couple events, like the what is it, Boys and Girls Club. They have these fireworks every year. And you wear the high heels, and it's wonderful. And I just had to sit there, look pretty, do absolutely nothing, because I would ruin the clothes. So part of it is just the functionality. But it takes a certain setting just to wear those clothes.
I think that for me, this is similar. That it's just, it's too much stuff and nonsense. There's too much care involved in it, and it totally constricts your behavior. Child Hassam was asked his credo for making art, and he said, "I believe that the man who will go down to posterity is the man who paints his own time and the scenes of everyday life around him." And I wondered whether you thought about the everyday life around you in terms of your work, or are you splintering off mainly in your own imagination?
No, not. And the imagination is another kind of a studio, but I'm very much interested in everything around me. And often I think of myself as a writer, because I go out looking for things to happen. If I work just at the studio, I feel that nothing's going on. I'm just expressing myself in whatever state I'm in, but I'm not really experiencing life. And also vicariously observing other people's lives, because I can live my life, but other people are living theirs, and being able to be a part of it or have insight into it is really valuable. So that when I do an artwork, the pieces of which I think as a book of one page, you know, those 32 by 20 works, I'll pick a subject and I'm try to address the universals of it and the background of that perception comes from looking around me constantly. I mean, that's my favorite thing to do.
And would you say, I mean, I think of my own work. I think when I first started making art, I fled from everything that was common every day and definitely was driven by the imagination. And I found it too obvious or too unengaging, at least for me. And it turned out I ended up living with an artist, William Anastasi, whose very work was embracing that. And he had come from the working class, and I had come from upper middle class. And all of a sudden, this whole other world came into my consciousness, and something that I had really been snobbish about, suddenly I started paying attention to. And even in the Zen idea of if you do something once and it bores you, do it twice, and if that bores you, do it four times, and so on, 16 times, and eventually boredom gives way to involvement. And so gradually, really, through him, I became involved in the everyday. And in repetition, and even the love of repetition. And so it was a real gift, because after a while, this kind of search, you could get lost in the imagination, and the search to try to find exoticism, could play out.
Yeah, that's right. If you just rely on your imagination with no... It's like I think imagination can be used as a kind of sonar. You know, you send a beam down to these parts of what's in front of you that you can't see. And you go through the visible surface and you go inside, and something comes back. Signals are constantly coming back. And eventually you get a kind of topology that you're feeling your way around in the dark. And you go, oh, this feels like this. And I think I know this, or this is familiar, or it's something that I've seen before, or maybe it's something you've never felt before. But then the work is to bring that into the light for everybody else to see.
Yeah, and you get away from sort of your own driveling and your self-absorption and out into the world, where you're really an observer. Where?
Yeah, and I think that's at least, see, because the way I do art is not the way somebody else is supposed to be doing. And I think all art activities are equally valid, certainly for the person who's doing them. So I just want to do my artwork in the way that suits me, that fascinates me. And you hit on it, like being an observer. I think that's one of the things that an artist can do today, especially when you use language, is to look around when nobody else has time to, or everybody else is focused on another function, thanks to which the artist has the free time. If somebody's growing the food, the artist can be fed and look around. But I think increasingly that's a very important activity, to look around and highlight certain almost theaters of activity, because they're also an expression of somebody else's ordinary that might be an ordinary that, if it continues unchecked, will eventually suppress art or the capacity to do art. They're woven together. So I think there is a kind of public service an artist can do by looking around for its own sake.
And... here, a man, this is something that Goethe had written, that a man who is unable to despair has no need to be alive. And something from Chuang Tzu that kind of matches that. With the torches of chaos and doubt, the sage lights his way. And I wondered if you found that, the indecisive, the lost, or the useless, or worse, despair, which most people flee and don't want to spend any time on, not that you're wanting to go to these places, no one would want to necessarily seek them out to embrace them, but that you would find that certainly fertile territory.
Yeah, yes, it is. It's, there are different instances, like when something falls or the glass breaks, I don't get upset. I go, oh, the laws of physics are still working, right? But when I'm uncomfortable, let's say because maybe I did put my foot in my mouth or something like that, and there's this kind of squishy, uncomfortable feeling, I keep asking myself, is it possible to be comfortable, to be accepting of the discomfort such that you take it on as part of life? And the answer I still keep coming up with, although certainly not the final one, is no, it's supposed to feel uncomfortable because you've been turned upside down. And when you're upside down, if you didn't feel uncomfortable, you would do nothing to rectify it.
You'd be crazy.
Well,
that's how you're supposed
I was
to
just
feel.
Thinking, that, yes, there's a certain kind of built-in ballast, center of gravity. And so the thing is to, the best I've been able to make of my discomforts is to know that they'll pass, breathe, and just relax and go through them.
And use it. Use it in your work. Use that energy.
Yes, because I actually don't like pain or discomfort. I think that that's a sign that something has to be healed. And I don't agree for myself with those artists who wallow in the despair or think that it's necessary. And for some people it is. I mean, some people, whether it's a chemical imbalance or life experience or whatever, they have a great weight to carry around that they can't.
They wear as a badge of honor. And I agree, that's like really self-indulgent. Do you?
Well, no, I wasn't going to say it's self-indulgent. Mm-hmm. I'm saying that's beyond their means to lift off. But I think if it's possible to lift it off, then that would be the very first thing that I would do.
Yes. Yes. Do you think, is there anything uniquely American about the work, your work? Or don't you think in terms of those terms?
Well, I can't think in
line. I just brought it up because the format, it's only because we're interviewing, if I were, most of, and all, in fact, all my questions were really questions or thoughts that every artist around the world would be engaged in. But because we're in StoryCorps and thinking of American stories, that thought occurred to me.
Well, definitely. I think what's American about the work that I do is that I don't feel the necessity to first establish the traditional the traditional shoulders, let's say, such as in China. Even though the work I do in the script that I designed looks Asian. And you would think that there's some sensitivity to the Asian or Middle Eastern relationship to tradition. I don't believe at all in the tradition for myself, because if you get to the essence of something and it works, which I think is the great thing in America, if it works, no matter how absurd it seemed at first, you do get credit for it. And you get the benefit of something working, and there's a great freedom of thinking and executing ideas, and I think in that sense I'm very American, because I really appreciate the conceptual and expressive freedom that's certainly attached to the image of America, and that a lot of people expect to be able to practice.
Yeah, this idea of self-invention, and you've even invented a whole language. And then the language has a script, and the script is, as you say, I thought of it as more Arabic. But, you know, the script anyway has this you know, curving. And it works because it communicates, because people can use it as they could use, let's say, the Morse code. It could go beyond the art world and go into codes.
Well, it is. I'm thinking about, at what point is a code a writing system? Because the language I use is English or any Roman alphabet-based language, but the writing system is the invention, because, and there's studies in this, that the way you write, the writing system that you use demands certain coordinations in your mind, and those pictorial ones, like Chinese, do have more right brain associated activity. So the one that I do, I can't help but say you have increased right brain activity because you've got to make all these compositional choices. And so in that sense, just feeling the space, like a Grand Canyon, being able to wander and go where it leads me, I think is very American, and not caring what people think. As it's interesting to me and I'm not breaking anybody's spirit or laws, then what's the problem? You know, I can just keep going in that direction. Somebody said to me, why do you do this? And I go, well, why not? And because he lived in America long enough, he goes, yeah, why not?
It's a form of self-employment.
Well, certainly.
As John Cage liked to call the practice of art.
Oh, definitely. Self
keeps you off the streets.
Yeah, self-motivation and...
And it communicates in this case.
D'être.
Yes, and in this case, in fact, it's not just, you know, onanistic. It, it connects. Do you have time for any more questions, or we should end? Okay, so I was wondering, this is a big one, and you can totally dodge it, but I was wondering if you were to describe your trajectory as an artist in person in terms of a myth, either personal or, say, from the Gestalt, like Norse or Greek or Arab, Asian, Indian, whatever, how would your story go?
Well... to give you an answer that I could, say, embrace wholeheartedly, I'd have to let it sit. But I can tell you the myths that I carried around, the classics illustrated, that I still believe are going to be collector's items. It's sort of a pension. I collect these little things. I think that's going to be... Well, the one I had was Thrushbeard, where this princess went and... wouldn't marry any of the suitors because they weren't good enough. And so the father said, I'm going to show you, you're going to marry the next person that comes to the door who happened to be a beggar. And her father married her off to him. He took her to a hovel, made her sell pottery on the street corners and made sure that they got broken by the horse he was riding and made her... do beds out of straw, and then she had to go serve stuff in the castle and watch all these people. And she goes, oh, when I had it, I didn't appreciate it. Now the latest prince is coming to town, and it turns out to be that the beggar was King Thrushbeard in disguise. And then the other one was the stepmother that makes you do these impossible tasks, except these fairies help you, like ladle out a lake with a spoonful of holes or sort feathers by size. And at the end, the wicked witch, or was a stepmother, I think, got banished in the woods and lived happily ever after.
And you see yourself as the princess in either case?
Well, let's say I see life as having, why shouldn't life be happily ever after? Because I really think that one creates reality. I'm most convinced of that than anything else, and I've been willing to see the opposite, and I think I've gone through enough trials that I could be pessimistic with cause, but instead I feel very optimistic that there's a relationship between oneself and one's heart and what one gets to experience in life.
That's very well and beautifully said, that you create your own reality. Maybe
as far as I know, I keep looking because I don't want to be like a delusional person, but I keep looking because we didn't get into this because I want to be a doctor first and nixed that when I realized I wouldn't have 100% devotion because I had other interests. But I think this notion of healing still stays with me, that if you
in your work.
Yeah, if you can, don't restate the problem, but offer another way of looking at something that makes the problem a beneficial experience because it contains its own solution if you see it clearly enough.
Or makes you at least pay attention.
Yeah, and you'll be glad because you feel that you can solve things rather than be at the mercy of them.
Yeah, I think it's true that one of the most extraordinary things that art can offer, either as a practitioner or as a viewer, which I am both, because I'm a great art lover, and is just to pay attention.
Right.